This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to our 21st annual Writers Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Dean Nelson on the journalism faculty at the university, and it's our great privilege to have Robin Jones Gunn with us tonight. Robin has this amazing ability to write fiction that follows characters over the years. And when I don't mean just a couple of years, many years. She has several series which are targeted for teenage girls. The Christy Miller series, the Katie Weldon series, the Sierra Jensen series, Glenn Brooks series, and now she writes more for an adult women audience in her Sister Chicks series. She's written more than 80 books, sold more than 5 million copies, has been translated into more than 10 languages. Robin Jones Gunn, it's a great privilege to have you with us on our program today.
Thank you.
Seriously, 82 books? How is that even possible? I'm not sure I've read 82 books.
You know, I think it's 90 if you count all the children's books and the novellas and...
So how is that?
It's a lot.
This is all you do?
I'm older than you think.
Well, All right. Well, actually, I want to talk with you a little about the children's books, because you started there.
I did. With
several children's books. But what I thought was interesting about that was you still didn't really feel like storytelling was your gift. In fact, you thought it was your weakness. You were writing children's books, but you thought storytelling was your weakness. Anybody who has heard you tell a story can't imagine that you would think storytelling would be a weakness. How could that possibly be?
It's because when I was growing up, I got in trouble for telling stories. They called it lying.
Yeah, okay.
So I was always stop embellishing and get to the point. And so I just felt like this imagination that I had that was so full was really something that needed to be squelched. But then after I was married and we had children and I'd gone to a writer's conference that my husband pushed me out the door to go to and thought I could write a few articles, and I did, and they were published, and then, well, I could write some children's books because we have two small children, and then I did, and it just kept growing from there.
If you don't mind my asking, what were you lying about?
Well, it was more of the story getting bigger than it really was. If, you know, my lunchbox didn't make it home from school, there was a really interesting reason that I could come up with why it didn't.
Right, the zoo, the gates had come open on the zoo.
And a kangaroo got out and took it in his pouch. And
Yeah, okay. So those kinds of lies. Yeah. It wasn't that you were...
No, not intentionally.
Really lying.
No,
in that.
No. It was just more of a being in a... setting where it was more desirable to be seen and not heard or to be to the point. So it didn't seem like this wild imagination and embellishing was something that should be nurtured.
Got it. But even as you said, you took this creative writing class or went to a workshop and you started getting some things published. Mm-hmm. But you still considered it just sort of a game at that point, right? I can get a poem, I'll submit a poem here, or a short story there.
A hobby.
Yeah.
Everyone should have a hobby. This is interesting.
Yeah, so what was it that, I mean, were you still thinking this isn't something to take seriously?
Maybe at a few points I thought I could do something with it, but I didn't feel I was qualified. An author was someone who was accomplished and had a doctorate, or I don't know what I thought, but just that...
Just not you.
Yeah, just to be a simple storyteller was not a strong enough reason to pursue a career in writing.
Wow. And then you had, as we say in storytelling, you had this inciting incident.
Yep.
And the inciting incident was you were on a retreat with the kids that you taught Sunday school and found them all reading books in a tent instead of being out there playing in the water or at the beach. And what were they reading?
This was at San Clemente State Beach for a summer trip. My husband was a youth pastor. And the girls had brought with them from the public library a stack of romance novels that were, they were 13 years old, and they were reading very evocative stories that had a lot more description than they should be made aware of at 13 years old. And so I crawled in the tent where they were and read some of the books with them and said, "Does your mother know this is what you're reading? And I don't want you reading these books. I think there's other things you can read." And then they challenged me to find the kinds of books they wanted, love stories and all the ways that the books would have that more appeal to a young audience, for teenagers. And I had a hard time finding the kinds of books they wanted.
I love what you did, though, because you went to a bookstore.
Yes.
And started going shelf by shelf, yes, saying, where are some books that would appeal to what these young ladies were saying, you know, wasn't around. You found some books for them. What was their reaction?
I gave them to them. They read them. They read them twice. They read them three times. They gave them back and said, give us some more.
So, but there weren't any more.
There weren't any more. And so then they challenged me and said, why don't you write books for us? I was timid and terrified. And, oh, I couldn't do that. That's all those words. I just write children's books, like 7 words on a page. That's about my speed.
Or I submit a poem here, or
yeah,
a devotional there, yeah, or a short story there. You still weren't seeing this as something you should be doing.
No, not particularly. Maybe the only hint that I had was that I had a devotion that was published, and they asked how I wanted my name to appear. And I wrote Robin Gunn, because I'd been married about 5 years already. And my parents were at the house, and my daddy saw that. My daddy, who was son of a Kentucky coal miner, and he was kind of proud, and he said, you put Jones in there. You've been a Jones a lot longer than you've been a Gunn. So I, okay, Robin Jones Gunn is now my pen name, and that's... That, maybe where I felt like maybe there's something,
yeah,
there.
Louise
feels, Malcott.
Feels
Harry
like
Beecher
a writer.
Stowe, Robin Jones Gunn. It kind of has the flow.
It rolls right, rolls right off your tongue. Yeah, so you started writing these kinds of stories, but what's so cool about this is they were your built-in focus group.
Right. Those girls knew what they wanted, and so when they challenged me to write and I started writing and I read it to them, they told me what they didn't like. Over and over and over and over again.
Hold it. You say they knew what they wanted. What did they want?
They wanted a love story, and they wanted a main character to be a girl that was just like them. Average, a little shy, not anything noticeable. But then they wanted good things to happen to her. So I had Aunt Marty with all the money take Christy shopping and give her mm-hmm. a makeover. And, mm-hmm. you know, the fantasy kind of things that they hope would happen to them so they would fit in better in their school. And
so, well, no, this is good. We're going to get to...
look on your
no,
face.
No, we're going to get to that story that you wrote for them. But you wrote the stories, or you wrote a story. You had them check it out and fix it, and you fixed it, and then you took it to a publisher. And you,
right.
And you took several of these stories to a publisher. The publishers were saying, nah.
We just don't see a market. We can't really identify for the teenagers that this kind of a romance would really sell.
But you knew that was wrong.
Yes.
You knew that was wrong because you had these...
The girls in the tent.
Exactly.
So I wanted to tell the publishers, go look in your daughter's bedroom. What is she
yeah.
reading? It's
yeah.
the girls in the tent. I know there's this whole audience. They're just sort of submerged. They're the underground. We need to get to them.
So, but did you feel like... I got my signals crossed somewhere because I know these stories work, but publishers are saying, forget it. So were you tempted to just say, eh?
Yeah, of course I was tempted to just give up and felt like it's true. I don't know what I'm doing mm-hmm. and I'll just copy these stories and give them to the girls and I'll be done. But there was a fire in my belly to get it beyond there because there were other girls in other tents and other
yeah.
states and other places that were looking, I knew, that were looking for the same kind of book.
This is what I love about this, the whole evolution of this, because you knew. You just
I
knew
did.
that this was important and that
yeah.
people would read this. And you knew that the publishers were wrong. But you were willing to just photocopy the stories and...
Mm-hmm. I had a bulletin board in my little corner where I wrote, And I had all the photos. The girls would give me their school photos. And so this is my audience. So I'd pin them up on the bulletin board.
Interesting.
And I'd sit and type, and I'm telling you a story. And
really?
I knew who they were. I knew what they wanted to hear.
Wow. And then somewhere in there, there was a, I don't know where this happens in the timeline, but you read a C.S. Lewis quote.
Yes.
that connected, or it really resonated with you in some way. What was that statement from C.S. Lewis?
Perhaps you're thinking of when I was trying to find time to write, and I couldn't, with two small children and my husband doing youth ministry, so I was always helping him out, and I was working part-time, various little jobs. And I read in C.S. Lewis' Letters to an American Lady, she asked something about how he got so much work done. And he said something to the effect of, "I love the still, dewy, cobwebbed hours of the morning. I rise before dawn, make a proper pot of tea, and get all my correspondence done before breakfast." And I just closed the book and thought, if it worked for Jack, I'm going to buy me a teapot. And I literally bought a teapot and started drinking tea. And I set the alarm, and I got up at 3 in the morning, 3 days a week. And those were the best hours. No one ever called. It was quiet. And I could write and write and write. I did that for years, for maybe 15, 18 years, because that was the only way to get the work done.
You've got this great quote in one of your books where you say, "What good would it do to say, one day I plan to write a book unless I set my alarm, get up in those cobwebby hours in the morning, and actually start with chapter one, page one?"
You know, I hear from so many people that that's been a dream for a long time, and they just haven't started. And so they write to me to say, "How do you get started?" And it's very simple. You just get up. You get started. You start someplace, and then you show up and keep doing the hard work and keep working and rewriting. And it's hard work.
It is hard work. It isn't just telling stories to girls in a Sunday school class. It's getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Still, I'm really impressed with how you became a student of the publishing world. I mean, you mm-hmm. talked to bookstore managers. You said, mm-hmm. "What are people buying? What are they interested in?" And that helped shape you as well, didn't it?
Absolutely. When I was writing the children's books, I had a job at a bank. I hated that job. I don't like numbers. I like words. So I had to, for 5 years, just to make ends meet, go and work with numbers every day. And yet at lunchtime, I would sneak out, and down the street, there was a bookstore. And I would go in with my notepad, and I'd ask the people working there, "What do people come in and they're looking for, but they can't find it for children's books? Or what is it that is selling really well right now?" And I'd take notes, and I'd read all those books. And so it was sort of a self-education of what the market was.
So did that then shift how you wrote your stories, or the kinds of stories you wrote? Once you had that information?
Well, I think it gave me a larger view of what was out there, because I think so many writers get into this isolation bubble where they have a great idea, and so they just keep working on their idea, and they're not aware of how things are going in the market, and then they're so surprised that they can't find an interest from a publisher. So there's trends, and it goes up and down, and sometimes you have to put aside one project and start on another one, but I needed all the help I could get. So going to a bookstore was a good place to.
No, it was actually brilliant, because then you could see what was happening and maybe start to write into that kind of a market. So I just thought it made sense. But you've got this great quote about this whole writing process, where you say, "The writing journey had befuddled, humbled, and amazed me in ways I had never experienced before." Why was it befuddling? You knew these girls wanted these stories. Why was that so befuddling?
Well, this is really in reference to, as I continued to write, mm-hmm. the befuddlement was clearly on sitting down and the days where nothing would come, and you just knew you had to keep at it, and being so befuddled of, "I had so many ideas yesterday when I was at the grocery store, and where did all those ideas go?" And to have that feeling that you can, it's like running around with a butterfly net. You're like capturing the thoughts. And then you get home and you want to take the butterflies out and stick a pin in their backs, but they're all gone. And you just have this befuddlement of, I am so in need of the space as a creative person to get the emotional well filled up, and so that it just kind of bubbles over. So when I sit down to write, I'm not just befuddled and, you know, feeling like there's nothing to draw from, but rather it's really full. And
so how do you capture ideas now? Now that you've done this for several years, do you just, I know people who just write them in their phones real fast. They get
I haven't started that yet in my phone, but I always have a notebook with me or a journal, and I'm always jotting things and taking notes and cutting things out and putting them in binders and just sort of, I'm a collector. I think all writers are sort of collectors and sorters and stackers. Like, that's all we do. We just kind of gather it together and then sort it out and stack it up.
And you do that physically, though. I mean, you have a physical binder that you put photos and notes and things like that. So that this book project, what do? You just spread this stuff out and say, all right, I'm ready to write?
Well, I start with... I always write a prayer of dedication to the Lord before I start, because I feel like this is something He's blessed me to be able to do, and I want to always say thank you ahead of time. And and I dedicate every project to God. Like, this is yours. Do with it whatever you wish. And so I write the prayer and put it in the first page, and then after that, it could be a variety of maybe something I cut out of a magazine and put on a piece of paper, or some notes that I took. And then when I start writing, I always write by hand the first few pages and put it in there.
Why by hand?
Because something happens in your brain, and the tactile way of pulling it out of you is different than tapping it, I think.
It's too easy to delete on a keyboard, in my view.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
You're committed to it when you put it in the writing.
Yeah.
I knew that was your practice, but I just wondered if you knew why that was your practice.
No, but someone can psychoanalyze that.
Yeah, yeah. But if it's working, stick with it. You know, you want to do that. So, let's talk about your first Christy Miller book.
Okay.
I noticed right away that I thought readers would be able to identify with this character, this Christy Miller character, right away, because she feels like she doesn't fit in. Everyone was cooler than her. She didn't like how her body looked. She felt very awkward. It just seems like that's a universal feeling for teenagers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I finished writing the first Christy Miller book, Summer Promise, I showed it to my grandmother, and she was in her 80s at the time. She read the book and said to me, "That's exactly how I felt as a teenager." I thought, Grandma,
that was that long ago.
You were born in like 1902, and you lived in the Midwest. Why would you feel just like Christy at the beach with the surfers? But it's that same universal, every young woman coming of age. How am I ever going to fit in? Why do I look the way I do? Why am I so clumsy? And so to capture those feelings in a teenager. And you know, these Christy Miller books were written quite a few years ago. Just last night, I met with some girls that were 12 and 13, and they had just read the Christy Miller books and were telling me all the things they liked about it. I said, wait, I have to ask you. Did you notice that Christy did not have a cell phone? Was that a problem for you? No, we didn't notice that. But, you know, when this thing happened and she felt like, oh, everybody's looking at me, I felt that way just last week. So they kind of, as they read in this generation, it's not for the technology or Facebook or something. It's just more for the feelings and the reactions.
Yeah, it just seemed like, of course, you have captured how people feel about themselves. And that was in the very first page or so. I assume that was intentional.
No, not at all. Because what happened is that when I started writing, the story began where Christy Miller is on the farm in Wisconsin, and her parents come in and say, okay, you're going to your aunt and uncle's for the summer, but don't do anything you'll regret later. And then Christy gets on the plane, and she's sitting and looking out the window, and then she gets to the airport, and she meets her aunt and uncle, and they go out to dinner. So what happened was that, because I wrote all that At the beginning, when I went to a writer's conference and turned in the first three chapters to an editor, I met with him after he'd read it, and I sat down across the table. I could see, and on the first page, red line, next page, red line. And he went page, 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 page. And then he stopped, and he had a big red circle. He goes, "This is where your story begins." And that circle was on. "I hate you, I hate you," Christy Miller shouted.
Because she's talking to herself in the mirror, right?
Beach towel and threw it at the mirror.
Yeah.
And just that was where he said, "That's where I got interested." And so that's how I learned from a professional editor going through. And nobody needed to hear about another airplane ride.
Yeah, good.
I needed to see Chris. I had the advantage of writing that part first so I could feel closer to her.
Well, and as the creator of the character, you needed to know how she got from Wisconsin or wherever she was to California. You needed to know that, but the reader.
Yeah, it was kind of off stage.
So, yeah, it was a classic start with the action.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing with a story.
Apparently,
right?
That's how you're supposed to do it. Well,
yeah, if you would have just asked me, I could have saved you a lot of grief.
Hey, wait, weren't you the editor across the
table? Yeah, I probably was that guy. So, the other thing though is early on in that book, there's a death in that book, very early on. I just wondered, did you worry about introducing something that unpleasant? Or I'm in a book that's just supposed to be, this is about a girl who feels awkward about herself.
But no, because I didn't plan it. I didn't know he was going to die. I mean, as I was writing, it seemed that it's always asking the what if as a novelist. I had a general idea what the story was going to be about. But then this one character, I was like, wow, what if Sean dies? Oh, spoiler alert. But.
Yeah. Yeah. Way to go. You just lost a big audience there.
But then that opened up so many more possibilities. And I had, in high school, I worked at a Carl's Jr. restaurant, and there was a guy that worked there that asked me out, but I said no because he rode a motorcycle. I knew my parents wouldn't approve. And the day after he asked me out, he died on his motorcycle. And it has a profound effect on how you view, like, all these things. Oh, do I look cute enough? Am I going to fit in? And then it's just, boom, these big questions of life and death and what really matters and what's my life all about? And so that opened it up for me in my late teen years to really think those bigger thoughts. And I thought, oh, I think Christy needs to do that in this first book. So she did.
That's really interesting because so you were still drawing from personal experience.
Yes.
From the grief and the big questions that you ask when you're that age or any age when something terrible like that happens. What this reminds me of is, you know, Catherine Patterson's book, Bridge to Terabithia. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why that book got banned was that one of the characters dies.
Yeah.
And people were saying, kids don't want to read about somebody who dies. And she's going, I don't know what your life is like.
Well, we cared too much about that character. That's kind of the tricky balance.
Oh, interesting.
You have to just kind of meet them but not know them. And you kind of have to think they're sketchy. I don't know. Sean kind of seemed that way. And so it was like you weren't endeared to him yet.
Got it.
And it's kind of like you can't kill a dog in a book because everybody loves dogs. So there's... Let's not even talk about cats. It's just you can't do that.
Birds are okay?
Apparently.
Yeah. All right. But there's also in that book early on, there's this really funny moment where she goes to a party and she's just looking for a soft drink and she goes and asks for some Coke.
Yeah.
And that just gets misinterpreted by everybody. That was just hilarious. I mean...
It happened to one of the kids in our youth group, and I overheard them telling their friends, and I was like, oh, and I'm writing things down. And one time, we were on an outreach trip to Mexico, in Mexicali, and all the girls were sleeping on the gymnasium floor, our sleeping bags and suitcases all tucked in these little... And I remember coming and getting in my sleeping bag, and the teenage girl next to me rolled over and was just, oh, this boy that she liked on this trip, and he said this, and she stopped mid-tears and said, wait, I'm not going to tell you anymore because you're going to put it in your books.
Really?
I'm like, no, you can tell me. Come on.
As you're reaching for your... Yeah, exactly. Well, this is so interesting, though, because really for writers, everything is material, right? Everything is potential material.
It's all free, yeah. It's all open season.
Yeah, so things people say, your own experiences, things you observe. Writers are always paying attention.
And that's why we put in the front of every novel that this does not reflect any real human or however that word, this is not based on any true circumstances because it's a mix of mm-hmm. it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but it's just interesting that you're still drawing from conversations that you had with some of these girls, mm-hmm. experiences that you had as a teenager.
Right.
All of this is helping shape how this story unfolds. So then, in the final book in the series, 10 years later, I think, in the life of Christy mm-hmm. Miller, right? Mm-hmm. So 10 years later, she's married, and she's still struggling. She is struggling with her place in the world.
Yep.
She has a dumb job.
Yep.
There's some money pressure. She's struggling with envy. Mm-hmm. Wondering, should she be having kids, getting all this pressure from all these people? These are also real problems that people face at that stage. And I was just really impressed with how you could capture that when she's in her mid-20s. Similar to how you could capture that awkward teenage, mm-hmm. I hate you, as she throws the towel mm-hmm. at the mirror. So, are we just not happy with who we are? you tap into something that's just so fundamental.
Well, I think that there's a way that you look at yourself or learn to function in society as you get older. But we're always our truest selves at the core, all the way through to the end. That's why my grandmother's saying that's exactly how I felt as a teenager. So that when a story taps into that echo, as you've called it, we feel the camaraderie, and we want to be friends with that main character. We want to journey with them because they have said for us what we're too sophisticated now to say out loud. But we get to see what they're really thinking and feeling, and we go, I feel that way too, but I'm not going to tell anybody.
That's one of the great things about fiction, is that people can read it and say, oh, I identify with this character. But they don't have to tell anybody, but they feel like they have told somebody because they've seen it in a story. So is this a conscious thing with you, where going back to the girls in the tent, where you say, when I write a book, I want to give a positive view about relationships and values and love? I mean, are you starting out with a premise that I want something positive for my audience to read?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I want love to triumph, and I want the characters to see who they are and grow through that, but to also have hope. Every story I write, I want it to have hope, because we need that as humans. And we need to feel that it's going to be all right, or I can get through this. And what's interesting is when I wrote the second Christy Miller book, the publisher had asked for me to do it a lot quicker than the first one. I think it took 2 years for the first one, but I think they gave me 6 months to write the second one. And I was working, and I had it all figured out. Christy's parents are going to get a divorce, and her brother's going to end up in the hospital. I had all these. Christy's going to develop an eating disorder, and I was researching everything on bulimia I could find and reading all these books. And I wrote about three-fourths of the story, and my editor wanted to see it to see how far I was coming along. And I sent it to her, and then I also showed it to some of the girls in the youth group that had wanted to read it. And one of the girls picked up the pages and just threw it at me, and she said, I have to live this stuff. I don't want to read it, too. Christy's parents can't get divorced. Her brother can't be in the hospital. She has to make it through high school without throwing up and, you know, trying to make herself lose weight. Like, let all that happen to her friends, but keep Christy. She's my role model. And I went, okay, now I know if we're going to be able to continue a series, Christy has to be experiencing all these teen issues, but in terms of those around her and how she responds and reacts and enters in or doesn't, but we can't destroy Christy. After the first book, we loved her. You can't.
Yeah, they got so attached to her. But this is really interesting that you would think that you would want to read something that was similar to what, you know, you're going through, because then you get that me too kind of feeling. But these girls were saying, yeah, but not that close.
Because at the core, it was a romance. Okay. Christy and Todd, we want a happy ending. Don't wow. take us so far down that we don't think we're ever going to get back
wow.
up.
Wow.
We want to ride along with her ups and downs, yeah. but we want to feel hope for all the things we're going through that it's going to be okay.
What did your editor say about what you had sent?
Start over.
Really?
Yeah, I started
from
scratch.
So the editor had the same...
She threw it in my face, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Did she say, I hate you, I hate you?
No.
Yeah, okay.
No, but what I did then, instead of all this research on eating disorders, I thought, okay, well, then the thing that happens is Christy's hanging out with friends, and they're going to shoplift, and they're going to get away, but Christy's going to get caught. She's going to end up at the police station. And it's on a trip to Palm Springs with wealthy aunt and uncle. And so what I did, we were in Southern California at the time, and I drove to Palm Springs. I took my grandma with me, again, in her mm-hmm. mid-late 80s. So grandma and I went to Palm Springs, and I found a hotel, and I went to the desk, and I said, I'm writing a book about some teenagers that stay here with aunt and uncle, and I wonder if I could see a room and kind of be able to describe it. Sure, come see your room. Here's our pool. Would you like to have lunch on us? Oh, well, okay. And I can write about lunch.
Note to self. Hang on.
My grandma loved it. And then I went to the local drugstore and asked them, well, if a teenager was caught shoplifting, what would happen? Oh, we take them back here, and they have to sit in this room, and here, sit in that chair, that's where they sit, and the police wow. come and get them, and I sat in the chair. The police, they didn't come get us, but my grandmother and I went to the police station, and we had our thumbprints done, and we stood, and my grandma did
it. You got the photo?
I wanted to feel that, yeah. They were so into it. Oh, are you going to write us in your books? My name's Bob. Okay, I went home and the book just like poured out because I felt it. I had never been in that experience as a teenager and I hadn't heard anybody talk about it. But to make it to be Christy, I had to act it out, so to speak.
Yeah, because you wanted it to be as authentic, because probably some of the people reading this would have maybe had a similar experience and going, no, you just made that
yeah,
up.
Yeah.
So it was an authenticity thing,
yeah.
right? Wow. All right, so there's a line from the last Christy Miller book, the book One More Wish, where the Christy character is helping a teenage girl pick some good books. And she wonders, where were the positive role models for women?
It's kind of like product placement there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was expecting her to reach for a Christy Miller book off of the shelf.
Well, you know, when I wrote that, I remember writing that, and I thought, oh, I better take that out. Oh, my editor's going to catch that. But then I'm glad it stayed in, because I felt like that's the call out to the next generation.
Oh, yeah.
To write those books. There are many books that need to be written that just stay locked up in the hearts of very capable writers. And so if they see that need and they realize, well, maybe this is something I can do. That's how I started. And I haven't seen enough happening for the next generation to.
Mm-hmm. See, yeah, that's interesting, because I saw it as this interesting bookend that this is how this thing began in the first place,
yeah.
was somebody asking, where are the positive yeah. role model kinds of stories for young women? And now you're asking it in the last
yeah.
book in the series also. So I just thought it was a cool way to connect the beginning to the end. And you're looking at me like,
well,
you
no,
had no I, intention of that's how it was.
No, I think that's really interesting, because that is sort of so many years of doing this that message hasn't changed, that we need those books with the role models. And so it's kind of like my Macedonian call stuck in the book. Come on over here and help me do this mm-hmm. and write these kinds of stories. I hadn't realized that till you were saying this book ends it.
But there are, in all of your books, though, there are these themes that revolve around conflict, and you need good friends around you.
Yes.
That's true.
That.
That's true from the Christy Miller through the Sister Chicks
that.
books. And that's, but I don't think that's a conscious thing necessarily on your part. That's just what you write from.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it a conscious thing?
I think that's just what I really believe and has been true in my life. And my husband and I, where we live now, have such good friends. And we love the community that we're in. Today is our son's birthday, and he's in Colorado, and he just sent me a text. I said, are you doing anything fun for your birthday? And he goes, well, some of the guys from work, we're all going bowling tomorrow night for my birthday. And he goes, I love living in a place where I have such great Christian friends that really come alongside and support. And I was like, that's what you love for your children at any age, and for him to feel like at 33 that I love where we live because I got friends that are good people and mm-hmm. I like hanging out with them.
Then I'm remembering there was an interesting scene in one of your, I can't remember which Sister Chick's book it was, but she is...
First of all, this, you know, Dean, that you read, the Sister Chick books just really amazes me. That's wonderful. I know it's your job. You're supposed to research. I go to the police station.
Yeah, you get your thumbprint. I read romance novels.
You read Sister Chick books.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, I'm ready.
But it was almost, it was just such an interesting repetition from the Christy Miller, the very opening scene of the Christy Miller book, where here is this woman who is pregnant, trying on a swimsuit.
Yes.
In front of a mirror.
Yes.
And it's, but it's the same.
Yeah, she's just 40 years old instead of 14 years old.
Yeah.
A different character. But every woman feels that. Don't you know this? You have women in your life.
Yeah, no.
You put on a bathing suit, you stand in front of a mirror, it's demoralizing. It's just terrible. The things you feel to be able to write about that, and then someone reads it and goes, oh, you just spoke to me. You just said what I felt, but I didn't know how to put it in words.
I know, and I'm using this as a compliment because you're able to capture what people feel mm-hmm. authentically, and for them to say, finally, somebody has mm-hmm. put into text exactly how I have felt when I'm not speaking for myself when I've you know, tried on something in front of a mirror, you just feel mm-hmm. terrible. So it's just I think it's one of your gifts. It's a very cool thing. However, okay, here's
the
however.
Bring it.
Did you really try to use this title for one of your books, Fat Chicks in a Finnish Sauna?
I did. The publisher rejected it.
Well, I wonder why. Seriously,
then, two years later, I was in Barnes & Noble, and they had Fat Chicks in Lawn Chairs. And I went, oh. No, I tried it because that's how every woman in midlife would feel. I get it's the bathing suit thing.
Yeah.
And yet, I didn't realize how offensive it could be to people. I was trying to...
You thought it was funny.
Be kind of cheeky. Yeah.
Yeah. And knowing you, I just thought, well, of course that's what you would think of.
You'd
think
it's really innocent. It wasn't I was trying to be so.
But editors rejected it for what reason?
That they thought that there could be something that would have a wider appeal. And so I...
Really? A wider appeal than Fat Chicks in a Finnish Sauna?
Yeah. And so, well, it's a Christian publisher, yeah? Okay, so... for their demographic, they knew what they could sell. They had to have all their male sales reps go into the bookstores and present this book. So to be taken seriously, we had to help them out a little. So what happened was my best friend Donna and I, soon after that, it was a sunny day. We lived in Portland, Oregon at the time, and we were sitting out in lawn chairs. And the Fat Chicks in Lawn Chairs, I guess, right there. We were comparing our underarm flap. Mine's wigglier than yours.
Seriously, people do that?
Yeah, and we had shorts on, and we're like, look at these varicose veins. No, look at mine. And we were laughing and going, what are we? We are close as sisters, but we still got it going on. And we're like chicks. We're like sister chicks. And Donna said to me, get out your notebook, write that down. You're going to want that word. And so I wrote down sister chicks and went back to the publisher. And they go, oh, we like that.
Sister chicks was...
Sister chicks. And it worked. And that was when Chick Lit was just getting started up, and so it was a good fit.
But again, the root of Sister Chicks is female friendship.
It is.
Right? I mean, you have these adventures, but that's just really an excuse to talk about the need and the longing for deep, deep friendships, right?
Well, it certainly was the foundational premise for that series, even though all the books take place in different parts of the world. But it's that feeling of we're never too old to dream a new dream. And when you have a good friend who helps stir up that in you, whether you've just gotten over difficult illness or something, and they say, come on, let's dream again. Hmm. That piece of friendship is really valuable.
You've had some books sent back to you by editors.
Yes, I have.
Telling you, mm-mm.
Start over.
Yeah, and you had been writing for a long time, so how did that feel?
Yeah, it's been quite a few. Well, it started with that second Christy Miller book, and I started all over that one.
But I mean more recently, after you had done dozens.
So that one felt like, okay, I'm trying to figure this out. No shame, on we go. And then I wrote, I don't know, maybe it was like 25, 30 books published, and wrote the Glenbrook series and got to book 7 in the series. And when I wrote book 8 and turned it in, the editor said, I know you can do better. I want you to start over.
And that had to sting a little.
Absolutely.
Was she right?
She was right. And I would tell her that gladly now. At the moment, I thought, what do you know? I mean, just how dare
don't
you?
Don't you know who I am?
Yeah, but just that feeling of you don't get what I was trying to say. And there's such a crazy thing that happens with shame where we just hide and we close in. And this was the biggest challenge in that experience to just keep saying shame off, grace on. Hmm. And then to not close in or give up, but to move forward and learn and dream a new dream and try again and be humble and open. And then it happened again. The worst one that happened was I had written a Christmas novella titled Finding Father Christmas. And actually, this was the fastest book I'd ever written. It was a novella, but I think it came out in about 2 weeks. Just every day I'd go and sit, and it was kind of crazy because we were in Hawaii at the time and August, and it was very hot, and I was writing about Christmas in England in the snow. But, you know, I'd read that Jack London had written To Build a Fire in Honolulu in August. I thought, okay.
Good enough for him.
Your imagination really has to be engaged to do this. So that first one, I really loved the story. It came right out. It won an award. And then they said, would you write another one? Engaging Father Christmas. Yes. And I wrote it and turned it in, and the new editor said, it's not romantic enough. We really wanted a romance. Could you go back? Okay, sure. I was just really plodding along. So I got the second version out. Oh, that was really hard. Sent it in. She goes, no, I don't think this is it. I think you need to really work at it. And this is what I'd like to see, this and this and this and this. So I wrote a third version. And I worked really hard and just tried to get that third version just right. Sent it in. Had to put off other books. I think I like the second one better, but not enough. Could you write it? So I wrote it a fourth time entirely.
Wow.
And after I wrote the fourth one, she said, you are just so off track. I'm just going to publish the second one and be done with it. And I don't know what I learned from that.
What to do with anger, mostly.
But
all that wasted effort? Or was it wasted effort?
Nothing's ever wasted. Everything's redeemable. Everything, you know, there's always a purpose for it. But then what's so interesting is that there's a film producer that has asked to do the two books together, Finding Father Christmas and Engaging Father Christmas, as one story.
Hmm.
And it's been almost 4 years in process, and the contract's signed, so we'll see how the production goes and when it actually airs. But if I'd given up, they needed that romantic story in the second one to pair with the first one. And if I just said, forget it, I'm not even able to do this anymore, it would have deterred this next thing happening.
No movie.
Yeah.
Isn't Christy Miller, aren't you looking at some television possibilities?
We have been for many, many years, and it goes up, it goes down, we have interest, and it goes away, but I have another meeting this week, mm-hmm. actually, so...
We'll see.
We'll see, yeah.
You told me something not long ago that you got some advice for you as a writer, and that is to listen to good mm-hmm. poetry. What does that do?
Years ago, Bodie Taney told me that because she was so dyslexic and couldn't read, her mother would read to her Sir Walter Scott novels and all these classic British literature, and that it put in Bodie this love for words and how the English language fit together. And so as she and I were talking about that, I asked her if she liked poetry, and not so much, but I really love poetry. And so I went and downloaded some 50 best English poems and things like that that mm-hmm. were really easy to find, mm-hmm. and would listen to them over and over, because those masters of our language were able to weave the words in such a melodic way that you just could feel it resonating, the harmony. And this is our language. English is beautiful. And I became so much more appreciative of how to craft an economy of words to just simply craft that description. And so that helped me a lot in writing.
So you applied what you were hearing into what you were writing.
I felt like I would absorb the lyricalness of the poems, so that when I would sit down and write, I'd have that meter, that rhythm sort of
rumbling. That's great advice.
Yeah.
It's
our language. We only have one language that we... Well, some people master more than one. I've only got English. I might as well really study it and master it and love it.
All right. So let's take it out of that realm of beautiful language and all that and into social media.
Okay.
Okay, because... oftentimes, that isn't beautiful language. It's just very utilitarian. How important is social media to you as a writer?
I love it because I'm able to connect with people all over the world. And just a little word of cheer or encouragement on either side means so much to be able to have that back and forth in real time. That's amazing. But I think also with social media, there's a chance to say... to those who are listening, here's the deeper things. Like if someone would go to my blog, that's where I would, here's what's really rumbling around in my heart. And that it's sort of, it's open to the world, but those who make the effort to come in and find it, I'm a little more vulnerable, sort of the bonus material behind mm-hmm. the scenes.
Yeah, and you can get feedback. I've heard from writers when they say they get some almost immediate feedback from an audience, and so then they know, okay, I need to alter. Because do you put chapters of books?
I've not done that, but I have gone on. Before I wrote about Christy and Todd in the married years, was something I wanted to do for a number of years, but. Wasn't sure, and so I put on Facebook, hey, if I wrote a book about Christy and Todd and their marriage years, would you be interested in that, or just in an ebook, or do you want a paperback book? And I had over 1,000 comments within a few hours.
Wow.
Yes, 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 yes. So, okay.
Good enough.
That helps.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No,
being kind of like in a career that's in a vacuum in some ways that... Well, I think this is a good idea, but does anybody else?
All right. Well, let's keep going on the kind of on the business side of things. You've done some self-publishing recently, which, you know, would you agree that the stigma of self-publishing means you're a loser, that stigma is kind of gone?
I think it's dividing so that there are plenty of I wouldn't call them losers, but I would just say they really needed a little more work, a lot more work. They weren't ready to be published. There's a reason they would have gone in the slush pile at a traditional publishing house. But just because they can self-publish, it does give them a start, and the books are out there. But there's this divide where they're with the state of the publishing houses now and how difficult it is for them to make their numbers. They have to be guaranteed, even with the known author, they have to know they can sell so many copies before they'll even issue a contract. So if they aren't really certain they can guarantee that, they're not going to take the risk. So with this three-book, Christine Todd, The Married Years, I didn't have interest from the publishers that I'd worked with before, because I just felt like it doesn't really fit a genre. The couple's married, the romance is over, I guess. I don't know. And what's to say? You know, we're waiting for them to get married, and they got married. Now you want to write about them some more. But that affirmation from Facebook was really timely. And then my husband and I were on a camping trip. I realized today a lot of things happen on camping trips. If I feel stuck, I should go camping, I guess. But
checking people's tents, see what they're reading.
What you got in there?
And then introduce yourself. Of course, that would be important.
That would be a bonus. But he said, just write the first book. Just pour out your heart. Just write the first book, and we'll figure out how to get it published. And so we did, not through Amazon, but with an actual printer and working with editors that do it as a profession. And then I have an online shop that worked very well to be able to sell to the readers who were ready for the next installment of Christie and Todd.
Yeah, and I will say, just visually, they look professionally done. They look like a traditional publishing house did them. And you can see when somebody doesn't put the kind of care into the visual look on the page, the designer, the editing, it did not look like a self-published book. Yeah, so props to you.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah. So now, though, you work with a group that provides training and encouragement to writers and publishers in places around the world where it's difficult.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
The association is Media Associates International. Mm-hmm. Every 3 years they have a Lit World conference that's held internationally. Mm-hmm. I've been to one in Brazil and in Kenya, England. And writers from around the world gather, and the workshops are specific for the basics of publishing and editing and writing. But what's so, you know, we have our Western ways of doing things, and we have our traditional ways of publishing, but every time I go to a Lit World conference and see these people who, they're working in Bulgaria. I went to Bulgaria and did training, and I was just telling my sister this today, that when we were there for 5 days of writer's training, every meal we had bread. One day we had olives with the bread for three meals a day. I mean, this is how they live. And at the time I went, Bulgaria had a 93% unemployment rate. And yet here's 20 writers who want to be able to express themselves and want the training. And so with MAI going in and saying, we'll provide the trainers and we'll go to where you are, and so that you can tell your stories in the heart language of your people. Enough of this taking all the books from the West and translating them into the languages, because it doesn't quite fit as well as a story from a person in that culture who's telling the stories of their people in a contemporary or historic way. And it's the best thing. Every time I go, I am so humbled at how the rest of the world is doing what we're doing here.
It's so easy. You can just call. You just self-publish a book. You can just call up a designer. You can call up an editor. Folks over there, not so easy.
Yeah, and some of them do it in fear of the government, finding where the printing press is.
Right.
There was a woman I met at the last Lit World conference
that was from China, and she told me that she wrote children's books because her husband preached at a registered church in China, and she had written some curriculum for the children because they didn't have any, not even translated from all the plethora that we have here. And so she wanted a Xerox machine, a printing machine, a simple copy machine, mm-hmm. so that she could provide this for other churches as well. And she figured out how to do that. She could donate her blood. So she stood up in church and said, I am going to go on Monday and donate my blood, and I'm going to do that as often as I can until we have enough money to buy a printing machine, and then we can send these little children's material home with them. And she showed up at the blood bank on Monday morning, and the whole congregation was lined up behind her, and they gave their blood. It was the blood of the people in China that is getting the printing and the publishing wow. done.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a completely different privileged way that we get to do this art. But it's more than art. It's a lifeline for so many people in so many countries. And that power of the story, the power of the word.
What an image. Mm-hmm. What an image. My last question, do you have some advice for the writers who might be in our audience or watching this on television? What would you say if somebody says to you, I want to write. Tell me what I need to do.
Good. You should. You should write, and you should pour your whole heart into it and work at it very hard and not give up. I really feel that there's so much more that can be done, and we give up too easily. And there's plenty of ways in our Western culture to get the training. Take a class, go to a writer's conference, get training through an online program. But the really fascinating thing about this art, like other arts, is that it will outlive you. Once you're gone, what you've written will go on. And so it's something of great value that if you take that work seriously and do the hard work, it can have immense value.
And go on and on and on well into next generations.
Yes.
Robin Jones-Gunn, thank you so much for being with us.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.